A student came for a one-on-one meeting this week and said, I don't really understand the difference between the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, and therefore I'm not really able to say whether I want to practice one or both. So I thought maybe I could talk a little bit about that. At Dekiling, we usually begin our practice by studying some of the basic teachings of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, you know, his four discoveries, that sort of thing. And then later, we gradually migrate to the Mahayana path, where some new pieces were introduced. For example, the Bodhisattva ideal. So right now, we're studying Shantideva's text, The Way of the Bodhisattva. And we're also studying that in conjunction with Gampopa's writings on practice, including a book called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which kind of outlines the whole path, quite a bit of depth. And also in the Mahayana, kind of overlaid or extended from the Buddha's teachings, were a lot to say about compassion and the role and the importance of compassion in awakening. And also introduced was emptiness. So in practices like Tonglen, for example, which we do quite a bit here, both the study and the practice emphasize the cultivation of compassion. And also they rely on some understanding conceptually, and even more importantly, on the direct experience of emptiness, by which I mean the fact that all phenomena lack inherent existence, that nothing, including you, me, exist from our own side without being in relationship with something else. In fact, without being in relationship with everything else. And then another aspect of Mahayana training, which he emphasized quite a bit in this community, is that we have to pay attention to skillful means, which means that practices are best when they're given and practiced in accordance with the needs and the capabilities of the person to whom the practices are being given. And I often express this as something like, we have to practice where we are. We have to start where we are, by which I mean where our level of understanding and our skill is. This is one of the reasons, you know, why we encourage some interaction at least with teachers one-on-one, you know, so that we can be clear about where you are and give you more individualized instructions about what to do next. And then also our teachings at Dekiling are also influenced by the Mahayana concept of Buddha nature, the idea that the potential for awakening is within all sentient beings without any exception, and that this is exactly the potential that the Buddha had. So the Vajrayana, on the other hand, which we could say is actually a form of the Mahayana or an extension of the Mahayana. Maybe if I had to describe it, I would say it's an advanced and esoteric form of the Mahayana, since it includes and validates all the Mahayana principles and practices, but it has another layer to it. And that other layer isn't actually separate any more than frosting is separate from the cake that it's on. It's just another layer of a different quality. But in this case, I guess we could say it's still the cake of awakening. So what does the Vajrayana have? It has tantric practices, things like what some people call deity yoga. I like to call them yidam practice, like Green Tara, Medicine Buddha, Nundro, all of which we offer. The Vajrayana also has, unlike the Mahayana, Guru Yoga. So these are practices that emphasize the importance of spiritual teachers as a kind of central character in your spiritual journey. So we don't currently offer guru yoga in public at Dekeling, though we will begin later this year. It has a few prerequisites. There are other more advanced practices in the Vajrayana toolbox, of course, which you may or may know, may or may not know about, like work with subtle energy systems. Some of you probably know something about that if you've practiced yoga for a very long time. And then there are the completion stage practices, which are actually usually done on long retreat. So my approach to teaching at Dekeling is based on the idea that you can't build a good house without a strong foundation. You can, you know. You can build a very fancy house and it might look okay from afar. But if the foundation is weak, the house will be prone to collapse. And in the case of practice, the house of practice will not survive then the deconstruction of our most basic and pervasive confusion. So I favor a strong foundation. So we have a kind of 90-10 system of training and practice for the moment, because that's where many of us are. We study and practice the building blocks, mostly Mahayana practices. And 10% we do, if any at all, the Vajrayana. When I mean the building blocks of the Mahayana, I'm talking about things like the six perfections, like generosity and ethical conduct, and so forth. As a student gets a foundation in these, which could be, you know, years or decades or lifetimes of practice, then you can choose or not choose to engage in Vajrayana, which not only shifts the methods, but also begins to use some very new tools and practices, like sadhana practice, in which you step into visualized and imagined worlds of enlightened beings, for example. Or you use ritual to integrate action and speech within an imagined sacred realm. And my experience tells me that there are two main differences experientially in those methods. One is that the student in a visualization practice leaves behind, kind of at the door, if you will, beliefs about reality and life and self. And they enter into a non-conceptual drama or opera of sorts, where everything that we're doing is scripted in the sadhana, in the text. And with body, speech, and mind, we create a new life experience, a new birth, a new life, a new death. And that creates, because it's experiential, creates new understandings, new experiences. Really, mostly it begins with new questions. And then the other way that it's different experientially, maybe from the Mahayana, is that the student chooses or agrees to put at least one foot in the mystical world. And I'm not talking about beliefs in the mystical world. No belief is required. We're not really just changing one belief system for another. But instead, the student agrees to open the boundaries of their sense of potential and to include some exercises, some experiences, which are not exactly mainstream to the dominant culture here in this country. Now, this is not unique to Buddhism. That's included in mystical Christianity and many spiritual traditions. And if I need to be concrete maybe about it, I could say, what kind of things does it include? And it would include things like ways of having communion with the divine. Why would we do that? Because it leads to a deep sense of interconnectedness with all existence. Or maybe I'm talking about the cultivation of experiences of the transcendence of ego, or the departure of an ordinary sense of an individual separate self, because that sense limits our felt connection with a greater whole. Or maybe it would mean things like opening to more intuitive guidance, feeling your way around, or looking for signs and symbols from the universe, messages kind of as guideposts to us about whether we should or shouldn't proceed in this way or that way. And definitely having one foot or both feet or up to your neck in mysticism includes allowing an evolving understanding of the nature of both mind and phenomena, how both mind and phenomena are. And what comes out of this is a gradual transformation and healing. And those transformations require a deep commitment of life energy. But they have the potential, in return for that commitment, to support healing on physical, emotional, and spiritual levels, to leave us more integrated and with increased well-being. And I suppose that I can't really speak from my own experience, but I suppose that it eventually leads to enlightenment. And one more thing about the Vajrayana that I'd like to say. This is maybe really true in the Mahayana, but even more so in the Vajrayana. While the practices are well documented and preserved, the resulting experiences are deeply personal and varied. And there are an awful lot of them that defy rational explanation, that kind of transcend the limits of conceptual thoughts and language. So most practitioners who engage deeply in the Vajrayana are drawn to it. Not, it isn't almost maybe a decision or a choice. It's kind of a yearning or a calling or a pull somehow. So part of the student's question was, how do I know how far to go down a path? And I thought about, you know, that's a very personal question. It's a great question. And most likely that decision of how far to go down a path is very personal, and it's probably a very gradual decision-making process. But maybe some thoughts are helpful. If I were trying to decide whether I should practice only in the Mahayana and whether or not I should continue on with the Vajrayana, or how deep I should go in those paths, I would probably begin with some self-reflection. And the first thing I would think about, is why do I practice? What brings me here? Because if you just came to be part of a community of integrity, then maybe mind on the breath meditation, shamatha, and maybe engaging in community life, maybe those two things are plenty. But if you are drawn by a deep existential question or a sense of unidentifiable longing, just feeling pulled into spirituality, then maybe you have to go further, invest more of your life. So the next thing I would do is I would, taking a look at both the practices I'm doing and practices that lay ahead, I would check for resonance as I learn about those practices. I can tell you that one of my most important practices for a very long time, I heard the music for that practice, and I knew that it had something to do with fearless compassion. And between the sound of the music and the knowledge that it had something to do with fearless compassion, I knew that I had to do that practice. Resonance is also, if you do a practice like Tonglen, taking and sending, and you discover, as a student did last week, oh, I really was able to feel the full spectrum of my generosity, where it was really flowing and where it was kind of okay and where it was really stuck and where I just met the wall. And I like that. I want to know those things. And then there's just kind of a what sings to you, even if you don't understand it in your first meeting. Sometimes you look at an image or you hear about a practice and you just know that you're going to do it. And the next thing I do then, kind of in line with that, is I do a little trial and experimentation. You can experiment with a practice and see what kind of results you get. Now, those are two different things. To experiment with a practice is a commitment to a certain kind of action. To commit to the practice and look for results is something else, and it's slightly more risky or more mistake-prone than just committing to the practice itself as an experiment. And the reason for that is many of our practices, their deepest and best results don't happen for months or years or even decades. And many of those results are the obliteration of old wounds or very deep habits or deep misunderstandings that have held us back in our life in some pretty radical ways. And so I personally think it's better to hold the model of trying a practice and seeing how you feel about it than it is to try and experiment with an eye on the results. Better to just focus on the method and see how it goes. So another way you could decide how deep to go in a practice is to rely on the advice or guidance of someone that you trust. And this could be a teacher. It could also just be somebody who's been practicing longer than you, but it should be somebody whose opinion you have confidence in. Not just somebody whose charisma you enjoy, maybe. Somebody who's done the practice and been on that path. And then maybe a last piece. I would say that it's important to understand that commitment is not a thing. It's a living process. And so how deep you go, how far you go, these are moving things. They're alive, you know? And as the circumstances of your life change, then your commitment, how deep you go, how far you're going, that might change too. But do remember that you can't expect to harvest fruition from a practice that you haven't really cultivated. And if I had some general advice about how deep to go, how far to go, I would say maybe one other thing. Do it now. Don't think I will do this at some point later in my life. Because as my very pessimistic friend once said, no matter how bad things are, they can always get worse. All right, now let's talk about what an investment in practice looks like. What are the, what would I call it, the markers of investment? So first of all, and you might not like hearing this, but I think that the amount of time that you invest in practice is a key marker. Now, the difficulty of this as a marker, you know, what comes to mind is, I think it's a Zen saying, even a chicken can sit and does. But they're not meditating, right? So assuming that when you do practice, you're actually doing practice, then I think that the amount of time spent in practice will predict or roughly correlate to the depth of your practice. And if you manage to carry your practice steadily at work and with your family, then the results could look quite wonderfully different also. Will look quite wonderfully different. So another marker might be that you invest in your practice. Another way that we can tell that you're investing in it is the depth of practice you're willing to do. And what I mean by depth here is, are you willing to go deep out into the waters of your practice and do your spiritual work there? Are you willing, maybe even despite fear and anxiety, to at a reasonable pace move into those fears and explore them and be curious about them and to be curious about their role and impact in your life? And another marker of investment in practice, am I investing in my practice, is study and contemplation. So we say the three wisdoms are study, contemplation, and meditation. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So Dharma teachers can give you a frame and a context and content for your learning, but you can expand that by diving into the body of literature that's written by great exemplars of the methods that we're learning in Buddhism. And this could be a little bit of self-study, or for some of you, a lot of self-study. This could also be attendance in classes and study groups, so you hear not only from teachers, but from your community members. So another marker of are you investing in your practice or not could be, do you engage in community service? It's surprising to me how many people do not correlate engaging in community service with efficacy in practice. This is in all of the old teachings, the old school Dharma. It's often referred to as the accumulation of merit, which I think is a kind of puzzling translation of the importance of engagement, the importance of service. I think that it could be expressed, let's see, well, let's just say what it might include. It could be participating in community activities or leading those activities. It could be volunteering to do work, anything from washing dishes at the vicarage to raking leaves at the temple, or being a greeter and that sort of thing. It could be offering to support community members and supporting your community with some reasonable portion of whatever resources or skills, time you have. All of those things will more deeply integrate you, not only to the community, but also to the tradition itself. And that will be especially true if you bring your practice, whatever you're working on, loving kindness, patience, whatever it is, to all of the work that you do in community service. And then another marker of am I investing in my practice might be something like that you seek guidance and mentorship. So a teacher or somebody a little further down the path than you to help you navigate, you know? And then the last marker that occurred to me, and perhaps you'll think of some of your own and share those with us, is, are you moving along in both the depth and the length of your path? So we talked a little bit about depth of practice a minute ago. Are you going to the edge? Are you digging deep? And by length, I mean, for example, it's very clearly documented in our tradition. You know, meditation, we have shamatha, vipassana, mahamudra, and each practice has a kind of beginning and entry level, and then embellished and advanced and so forth. So we either have the inspiration and commitment to deepen and lengthen our practice, or if we don't yet have it, we can actually make a wish to feel inspired to deepen our practice and lengthen our practice. And having gone back and forth between these things, you know, being inspired and aspiring to be inspired. And usually the way I do that is I read a number of aspiration prayers, which are written in very lofty language. You know, if you're going to aspire, you might as really go for the mountaintop. I think maybe the aspiration, the building aspiration to be inspired is the stronger path. But gosh, if you have inspiration, you might as well use it, I suppose. One thing I know for sure about moving along the depth and length of your path is that trying to go too deep or too far too soon will cause you more trouble than give you progress. You're likely to fall in a pretty predictable pothole, a near enemy, a far enemy, just to quit practice. That's likely to happen, and you're likely to be stalled for longer than if you just took time and went at a pace that you know in your gut is right. So be careful of that. I guess the key here, as I mentioned at the beginning, is that you should put some thought and intention into choosing your level of commitment and your path of practice. And so I can't say for you, if I don't know you, if I haven't watched you practice, watched you move and evolve, watched you fail, if we haven't had that opportunity yet, then you will have to look inside and make these decisions on your own. And of course, I'll help in any way that I can. But maybe some of the ideas that I just talked about will be useful for that. Remember that part of the meaning of karma is that you will not get a result for something you didn't, in fact, do. You won't get a result for something you never did. And you will definitely get some kind of result for everything you do without any exception. The key here, though, as I mentioned at the start, was that you should put some thought and intention into choosing your level of commitment and your path of practice. And part of it is to think about what you aspire to, and part of it is to actually get in touch with what you're doing. That's what I mean when I say intentional, like look and see. You think you're practicing a lot, but you never go to classes, and you never show up at Monday, and you have a 5-minute-a-day sit. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're a little out of touch. So take a look at that and check in honestly with yourself. And remember the principle of karma. Part of the meaning is karma, that you will not get a result for something you didn't do. You will not get a result for something you didn't do. And you will definitely and absolutely get some kind of result for everything that you do, without any exception. So I guess I want to say choose, check in with yourself, be intentional, and do it sooner rather than later, and do it often.